Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 48 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane from many different things. Tomorrow I know what I'll plug for that one.
Okay. We'll save that as a teaser.
There you go.
Yeah.
So welcome back, Jim.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is they're just never gonna get out of this little end of the slideway.
That's right.
Just more things going on, but lots of activities.
And we get another minute just of swearing dialogue.
Yes.
There are three quotes from this minute, and every one of them has swearing in it. Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess D'Souza had it easy this doing this minute.
Yeah, when he wrote the script. Yeah. Right, so.
Well, no, that's Willis, but
I'm just thinking the screenwriter probably just had to write shooting continues.
That's right. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there later today, and we will see what's there. And so minute 48 begins with the scaffolding folding up and crashing and ends with Barnes and John taking a break on the slidewalk. Maybe it's a smoke break. Maybe it's something else. You know, smoke them if you got them. Who knows? So yesterday we ended things with Sheldon falling off the scaffolding that John toppled over. Now, right at the beginning of this minute, when we talked a little bit about it yesterday, you know, there's actually only two layers of this plywood. You can see it now clearly. You know, you have John underneath, and there was one layer of plywood, and then you have a few feet, and then you have the other layer of plywood. And the second layer was where Sheldon was above it, and John was below it. So it actually makes me wonder if you're shooting a machine gun, if the bullet will get stopped at the first, you know, if it can go through two of them. Actually, you know what? Well, with Sheldon, you don't even have to worry about it going through two because he was shooting from the side, so he only had to go through one.
Yeah.
What's your estimation on that? Do you really think that, you know, that in a plausible real world scenario, this type of plywood would be able to keep someone safe from bullets?
Well, in a plausible real world scenario, we wouldn't have this movie. I would think definitely not. I mean, I've used nail guns, and I know that a nail gun would put through that, and that's just powered by very low. Yeah, low velocity.
Air. Wait, a nail gun? You're saying that the nail will puncture all the way through and fly up to the next one?
Well, a nail has, you know, a nail with a head on it. Even a finishing nail has a bump at the end. The bullet is built to deform and just go, you know, continue on. So it could expend a lot of its energy going through those first two pieces of wood, but I think if they're next to each other, it's just going to plow on right through. It would lose a lot of velocity going through, but I think it would still have enough to puncture something else, especially at the velocities that are coming out of.
Well, it's a good thing we're not in a real world plausible situation here then. You know, or at least John should be happy that he is, you know. And so then we see the scaffolding tip over, and John runs out of the way, and then we see Sheldon's face as he is, you know, terrified. And then you can clearly see that they use a dummy here for the scaffold falling on the body. I mean, I'm sure that they put a lot of work into that, but it looks too fake. You'd think that they would have tried to make it look a little more plausible.
I think it's the knee, the way that leg and the knee, I mean, although he could have broken his knee, but it's just that's where it really doesn't sell.
Yes. Cause the leg is completely off to the, you know, it's at a 90 degree angle.
Back to the bullet question. I was looking up an MP5 fires at roughly 400 meters per second. So that's That means that the bullets are traveling at 894 miles per hour, which is supersonic as far as I can tell. I don't see how it could eat up that much velocity going through that small. They're like half. Would you say those are half inch or three quarter inch? I'm not sure how thick that plywood is. I don't think
it makes a difference. Like,
it's flying at almost 900 miles an hour. Speed of sound there is like maybe 100 and a half less than that, assuming it's at sea level or whatever, you know, whatever Dulles Airport's at. I don't see supersonic bullets getting slowed down that much by a puny one inch of pine or spruce or whatever they're making the plywood out of. It's just glue.
Right.
So, oh well. But yeah, again, let's not bring the real world.
No, we don't need to. But also, I mean, if you freeze frame at the 2 second mark, you can see that this dummy looks absolutely nothing like Sheldon. You know, it's a much darker complexion, or at least it looks that way.
Yeah,
and he's thinner.
And he looks like he's wearing a hat. I mean, it's
yes,
it's just
They said, all right, let's just put this dummy over here, and you know.
Yeah,
and you're right. That
nobody's gonna freeze.
No, of course not. And the 90 degree angle leg is. You're right. That's what really.
Yeah.
You know that sells it. And then John jumps out and starts shooting. Now, one thing I wanted to say before when we see Sheldon lying on the ground about to get pancaked. Okay, we can actually see the badge that's on his. The fake badge that he has on there, and you can read that it says airport employee identification card, you know, and what's really funny is there's no picture on it. It just has like an F, I guess it says what area you're allowed to be in or whatever it is, and a signature, but no picture. So, you know, nowadays that wouldn't work very well.
Trying to figure out what the painting, or I'm assuming that it's the painting company logo on that
painter,
on that painter shirt. But what is that a drawing?
I don't know. Is that a face? Is it a tree?
I keep looking.
You know, it's Mr. Miyagi. It's Mr. Miyagi's painting company. You know, it's a bonsai tree.
Yeah, it's just. Wow, or it's a painting of. It's almost a Rorschach test. What do you see in this picture? It looks kind of like a smiling llama eating a piece of grass or something. I don't know. It's just very peculiar. That's my favorite part of Movies by Minutes, so that you can just dig down in things that nobody was expecting you would ever notice. And I do like the way that, they don't have an identification of him with a photograph, but they do have his thumbprint. Yes. Just in case they,
need to identify him.
Compare your thumb.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah. Well, they'll need it for the inquest, I guess.
One inquest, you know. Who knows?
I do notice that the floor. I thought, you know, the one part of the floor was tiled, but this looks just like a painted studio, a cement studio floor with just some paint splatters on it. So. I guess that this is the part that they haven't tiled.
Yeah, that's true. Oh well, they're not up there yet.
And is that a bullet that hasn't been fired to the left of his face?
A bullet that hasn't been fired.
Yeah, it's a round. It's not brass. It's just a round. I mean,
oh, you're right. Because it's got an extra. Point to it. You're right. But I mean, he does a great job of looking scared. Even though that's most true. People don't see his facial acting at this point. So
yeah, no, it looks you'd have to. This is it looks like the amount that you'd have to open your eyelids to put eye drops. That's how much the top of the white of his eyes are.
This little scene. They said, okay, pretend that you're being scared, and we're gonna pretend to throw something on you, and then in the final cut, you'll see that we actually do manage it. And he's like. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Now I have to admit the ground level impact shot where the dusty plywood hits him. that close-up shot does look realistic. But then when they cut to the master shot again, it's just, oh, that's a dummy.
Yeah, I'm assuming that shot's also a dummy, but, you know. Yeah. And then John starts running and shooting at the same time because, you know, Mulkey's the only one still alive. And as he's trying to run away, part of the scaffolding apparently also wasn't secured very well. It falls on him. And as it's falling on him, you can actually see the mural that you've been talking about all week. I mean, now it's even more beautiful to see what's going on here. I mean, you see planes from different eras that are.
Yeah.
You know, the plane the plane on the right hand side reminds me, you know, from Indiana Jones, from Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know.
Yeah, that one looks like it's done in the American Airlines paint scheme of what I'm assuming is either a DC-4 or possibly a DC. I think it's a DC-3
right. And,
though.
And there's a Wright Brothers plane.
Brothers plane. And there's some kind of discarded clothing or something.
No, it looks like a person. Isn't that a person?
What that
is that?
Is it a? Oh, is it? Are they working on the? Are they working on the same?
I don't know.
The other guy is. It just he has rather long.
That's right. It looks to me like skeleton also. So it's death pulling down the planes. I don't know. And you can see a balloon also. There's a, you know.
Yeah, like a dirigible or some kind. Yeah, up in the. On the upper right, and then there's what looks like a balloon that's deflating or inflating.
Right.
I guess it depends on how you look. It's a glass half full kind of a thing. To the very left, next to that towering building to the, in the distance. I would love to have seen what this original looked like, but maybe it's in one of the behind the scenes videos.
It's very possible. Very possible. If I come across it, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
And as the scaffolding falls on John, you know, it miraculously somehow, you know, it hits him on his back, but he throws the gun in front of him onto the slide walk itself.
Yeah.
You know, and then.
Just.
Yeah. And then Mulkey, you know, sees that he has the upper hand, tries to shoot again, and again, his gun is jammed. So he gets really frustrated, and, you know, we see. Then he screams the first piece of dialogue of this minute. He goes, "Shit!" and then you know, we get another shot of the distance. We see that Mulkey is on the other end of the slidewalk and that John is, you know, at the far end. And we get to see, you know, another shot of a dead SWAT guy with his gun on the side. And then we see John and the shot of John is from the slidewalk, and it's very cool because you see the gun, you see a whole bunch of used rounds around him, but then you also see what looks like a shotgun round. Now I don't remember anyone using a shotgun.
I don't see anybody with a shotgun.
Maybe one of the SWAT guys had a shotgun.
This must have been maybe the previous painters were there.
Yeah, then. And we see John groaning. And at this point, Mulkey grabs his gun again and screams, and starts moving forward, you know, and he basically jumps onto the slidewalk itself, where you once again see the dead body, and you can see the gun is basically halfway between John and Mulkey. And then John realizes what's going on.
Yeah.
And tries to move around and reaches for a pipe. You know, and now what's really funny is that there's a pipe that is closer to him, but he takes the further pipe. Yeah. Maybe because it's smaller. Maybe it's, you know, it's easier to handle. I don't know. Not really sure. And then Mulkey jumps onto the slide, to the slidewalk and screams to John, "I'm going to kick your ass."
See, that's that classic villain mistake of announcing your plans.
That's right. I mean, again, we had the same thing with Marco in the first Die Hard. Next time you have an opportunity to shoot someone, you should do it. And then John goes, "Thanks for the advice, pal." There's another example of shooting through wood. There you go.
Yeah. It's The thing that I don't understand about Mulkey is if you were getting near, like, he's closing on his prey, but he's doing it without
shooting. Because he can't.
But what he should have done is jumped over the side of the slidewalk so that at least he had a couple of, you know, he had the element of surprise. Right. There's no surprise.
And don't forget there are guns of the SWAT guys all around also. He could have picked something else up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. They can't all be malfunctioning. Wow, that is quite I would think that I'm surprised that the bullets. Well, I mean, I guess since he did just start it up, I'm surprised there isn't a bigger pile of bullets at the end of the slidewalk. Sure. But I guess it's been off, so it wouldn't do it. But it just seems like with the amount that were fired, there would be more rolling down. It should be about. He should be seeing his pistol sitting on top of an 8-inch pile of, exactly. Of brass.
And then John takes the metal beam and, you know, tries to reach the green button, and then it manages to press it, and, you know, the slidewalk starts moving. And I love the reaction of Mulkey, because, you know, he's like completely shocked. He wasn't expecting this at all.
Yeah.
You know, we see John trying to clamber and crawl his way towards the gun, and then Mulkey realizes it. We see that he's getting ready to run from his direction also. And, you know, we get the tension and the music changes, and, you know, who's going to reach the gun first? Do you think it'll be Mulkey? Do you think it'll be John? Could be either of them. Who knows?
gosh, yeah. And I didn't. There's this one section where he's reaching for the pipe, and I didn't realize this is the only section of flooring that's carpeted. I don't know where the carpet came from. When he's trying to turn off when he's
turn
trying
off
to turn
or
off
turn
the
on
slidewalk, I'm sorry, turn on the
slidewalk. Oh, you're right. It does look
you'll
like
notice
it does look like
that
carpet.
When he reaches
right.
for the pipe, there's. Yeah, so I'm not sure. I mean, maybe that's just the landing zone. It just seems like it would be difficult. If they have the whole place covered with tile, putting carpet there just
probably.
Seems like a mistake. But, you know, they didn't ask me to design the airport. So I just
that's right.
Let it go.
And then the shot gives us a close-up of the gun as it's moving towards John. And it keeps flipping. I mean, the editing is great here because it flips between the two of them. We know that John's the one who's going to be able to get the gun in the end, but they still make this a very tense and suspenseful scene. So I like how they do it. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
The editing is great.
I think, you know, it's a difficult set to explain the geography of it all. So I think getting back and forth and saying this stuff is all coming toward you. I mean, they take the axis that you're. The axis of the action is to the right-hand side. It goes from the right-hand side of the slidewalk where John is to the left-hand side where Mulkey's coming down. And they cross that axis a couple of times, but you still get the idea of
they do a great job of
laid
it.
Out.
Yeah.
But impressive.
For sure. And then John picks up the gun and shoots Mulkey at least 10 times. I lost count. You know, that's a little excessive. Yeah.
Yeah, you think his index finger's probably getting
John is in the middle of a firefight. Is he sure that Mulkey's the last guy standing?
Yeah.
You know. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah. No,
that's right.
Did you shoot him enough? It just keeps going and going and going.
What's great is John does not change his angle of how he's shooting, but Mulkey falls down and John keeps shooting in the same place. You know, so those last bullets are not going to be hitting Mulkey anyway because he's slumped on the ground. You know, so and then the body, you know, falls down on the slide, the slidewalk. Also very bloody. He falls backwards. We see blood splurting out of him as he's falling backwards, and John basically he empties his cartridge on him, you know, and And I love the way Mulkey falls and his like leg pops up and stuff like that. John then is completely out of breath.
Yeah, apparently that's the symbol for death in this film. Either an arm goes up or a leg.
That's
goes
right.
Up, so you know that they're truly dead.
And then we get a shot of the bodies of both Mulkey and the SWAT guy moving towards us on the slidewalk, and you know we see the wood that's on top of John. You know, as and then we see the wood just being moved over a little bit, and then Barnes comes into the screen.
Yeah. Where has Barnes been?
Hiding.
Yeah.
Hiding. That's what he's been doing. And then he turns off the slidewalk and then very easily, you know, pulls all this wood off of John. And then the two of them just sit in the slidewalk, catching their breath. You know, they have a moment of clarity, a moment to, you know, to breathe a little bit before they have to, you know, go to the next, stop on their trip.
Yeah. That's a common trope of somebody trying to get something done. And then the other guy comes in and definitely turns whatever it is on that's troubling him off. This reminds me very much of the Goldfinger scene where, James Bond.
And now you will die.
Trying to turn off an atom bomb. Yeah. He's just pressing, you know, he's trying to figure out how to turn off an atom bomb. And then Q just shows up and presses, oh, no, do it like this. Oh, okay.
That's right. So, I mean, we've been talking this week and last week also about a slidewalk. So I decided to look it up to see what it is. Do you know what the term slidewalk, where it actually comes from?
I would assume a portamento of sliding and sidewalk.
Okay, well, first of all, a slidewalk is a fictional term. It's not a real term. It is a moving pavement structurally sound enough to support buildings and large populations of travelers. Okay, so you have adjacent slidewalks that are moving at different speeds could let travelers accelerate to great speeds. This is mostly in science fiction. All right, it is colloquially now as a moving walkway. That's the term that they use for a moving walkway. You know, for I guess a moving escalator or whatever you want to call it. So I have a whole bunch of science fiction writers that would use it.
I'm gonna guess Heinlein's The Roads Must Roll.
That is correct.
Probably the top.
That's actually the second one. H.G. Wells uses it in When the Sleeper Wakes. Heinlein, as you said, uses it in The Roads Must Roll. Asimov uses it in his robot series, which imagines slidewalks as the potential method of transportation of practically the entire urban population on Earth, with expressways moving to up to 95 kilometers an hour, equipped with seating accommodations for long-distance travel. And with slower subsidiary tracks branching off from the main lines. Arthur C. Clarke uses it in The City and the Stars. And where's it mostly, where do we see it very prominently? In what futuristic cartoon?
I'm guessing Futurama.
No, The Jetsons.
Ah, oh yes, of course, the opening scene, yes.
Yeah, well, everything, they're always on these conveyor belts. You know, everywhere they go. I mean, even Astro uses Astro uses a treadmill. So a treadmill.
Yes.
All right. So what do you know about treadmills?
They're like slidewalks that don't go anywhere.
Okay. That's actually a very good description.
And when walking your dog on it, you have to play chopsticks or it doesn't work. I just, that's the end credits of the Jetsons is always with chopsticks.
Yes. So a treadmill is a device that's used either for walking, running, or climbing while staying in the same place. And they go really, really far back because, you know, you don't need them to be mechanical. They used to use them they'd have animals that were being used to move these treadmills, and they had people doing them also. You know, you have a treadmill and a tread wheel.
Yes, I've seen tread wheels were used in medieval times to build as a building, kind of a stationary engine.
Yes,
mm-hmm. my, My wife and I went to Burgundy in the Burgundy region of France, and there's a great project going on there called Gwendolyn. It's the Gwendolyn Castle. Well, what they're doing is a bunch of history investigators, different people from different academies and things, wanted to find out how medieval people built castles. And so what they did was, in the middle of a wooded forest, they're building a castle, and they used medieval technology to pick up rocks and do mortar work and things like that. And they're building this castle out in the middle of Burgundy. Right. And they have these beautiful hand-built the giant logs that they built that they've turned into tread wheels. And they get, high school kids to show up and do work during the springtime and the summer to help build the castle. And they have some of the kids wind up just being the human guinea pig that's running the hamster wheel. That's
right. Exactly. And I mean, the people have been using them, treadmills, for over 4,000 years to build things. They would use them to lift buckets of water. You'd find them in different grain mills. Sometimes they use it to pump water or use for dough kneading machines and bellows and stuff like that. And I mean, it was also used as punishment. In 1818, a English engineer named Sir William Cubitt, with two T's, decided that that prisoners at the local prison were being too idle, and they decided that you might as well take advantage of their muscle power to both cure their idleness and produce useful work. And they would basically, it would be something that was, they were climbing up steps basically, and they were basically walking up endless staircases in order to, to be used, in the prison for them to be able to power different things.
Wow.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
Project Sisyphus, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. There's wow. In the Brixton prison, there was an infamous mill that they installed in order to grind grain, and they would have, the prisoners were doing the work for it.
Wow. So kind of like keeping your nose to the grindstone as a foundation.
That's correct. That's correct. And did you know that when do you think the modern treadmill was created? The ones that when everyone listening to this thinks of a treadmill, what are they thinking of? They're thinking of, what most people have in their houses. And
yeah, I'm going to guess it's some guy named Jeff Pelleton, and he invented it in 1906.
Why would you say Jeff Pelleton? Is there a reason for that, or is it just...
thinking, I know that the Peloton, all those treadmills that Peloton. Okay.
No, so it's a man named.
There's probably some guy named.
It's a man named William Staub. Okay. Yeah.
Staub.
And he invented it in 1968.
That late.
Because he was reading a book called Aerobics by Kenneth Cooper. And the book noted that individuals who ran for 8 minutes 4 to 5 times a week would be in better physical condition. So he said, hey. Why not create something that you can do that? And he was able to do it.
I'm surprised that it would be that late or that recent to
And the first treadmill of that design was known as a Pacemaster 600.
Wow.
And
I wonder what Pacemasters 1 through 5 were like.
And what's even more fascinating is even today, the treadmill is the biggest selling exercise equipment by a very large margin.
Wow.
And there are hundreds of manufacturers throughout the world.
It's also probably replaced the clothesline as the most common thing to hang laundry.
Yeah,
on.
Probably. It's probably true. It's a fair guess. All right, you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
It's fascinating. At least there seems to be more direct action other than shooting and not getting anywhere. At least they seem to have they've achieved this level, and now they're they're ready to head on to other
stuff. Yes, and now it's just swearing, swearing. You know, shooting, swearing. All right, so the script, you know, picks up, and it says, I'll backtrack a little bit. So Sheldon aims, but then the half of the scaffolding beneath him gives way. He falls screaming, lands with a crunch beside Barnes. McLean has a moment of satisfaction. Then McLean says, "Oh, fuck." He runs and dives sideways as the rest of the scaffolding falls towards him, paint and glue and half the mural's tile grid coming down with it. McLean lands hard, the plywood boards from the top of the scaffold sweeping him off his feet. His gun skitters across the linoleum towards the far end of the slidewalk. He rolls over and sees O'Reilly 6 feet away. He too has ducked the falling scaffold, but he's already on his feet, already bending to grab his dropped MAC-10 from the slidewalk, bringing it up, aiming. McLean spins on the floor and slams the nearest piece of the metal scaffold into the open slidewalk electronics. It shorts out spectacularly. And then at the far end of the slidewalk, it whirs into high gear, treads shredding the slidewalk in overdrive. O'Reilly is flung right over McLean's head. He slams into the wall at the end of the walkway headfirst. There's a sickening crack as his neck goes, and then he twitches and slides on the floor, a smear of blood on the slick wall.
Surprised he didn't explode. That seemed like it was going at speed, and then it happened. It's similar to the end of the Johnny Cab in Total Recall. That it just.
Yes, that's right. And then it says McLean takes a long overdue breath. Then he picks up his pistol, checks the bodies to make sure there's no surprises. interesting, just very descriptive. I like the way they did it in the movie. I think it works a little better. You know, knowing who Robert Patrick is, as we mentioned earlier in the week, it would have been nicer to see him in that role. Yeah. But oh well. Huh. You know, they made the decision to switch O'Reilly and Mulkey for some reason. Don't know why.
Yeah, it's maybe just availability or willingness to do things.
Could be.
Wow. Oh, fun.
Yeah. All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Aviation Story Aviation Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story that's somehow related to an airplane, an airport, something like that. So Jim, what kind of story do you have? You always have fascinating stories. You probably have tons of these stories, but you know, tell us one that you think we'll find interesting.
Okay,
well, actually, they're all interesting. How can I say that? They're all interesting.
I'm trying to remember if I told this on any of your other stories. I tell this story sometimes. I've got an airplane story that is pretty scary. And this was let me take you back to 1990, August 1st, 1990. And I was working for British Aerospace. I worked in the Washington, D.C. office, and I was going to London. August 1st, 1990, I had to go over and work in the U.K. So I got on a Pan Am flight. I flew on a Pan Am flight. I don't want to say the wrong one. Lockerbie was 103. Lockerbie was 107. I was 103. And so I flew on this Pan Am flight to London, and it was a daytime flight. And we were going from Kennedy Airport in New York to Heathrow in London. I was over, if you picture a globe, I was over the N in the word Atlantic Ocean. Okay. I was over the N at about 35,000 feet. When they started the in-flight movie, and the movie was Hunt for Red October, which is about, it starts with Alec Baldwin.
Ooh.
Who was afraid of flying, watching, you know,
yes.
He starts the movie. So they start the movie, and all of a sudden the plane starts making this rattling sound, this boom, 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 boom sound. And the plane starts like jumping to the left a little bit. And the people that were sitting on the left-hand side of it, they all put their little curtains down so that they could watch the movie. But people started picking up their curtain, the little slot, the shade, and looking out the window. And there on the left wing, the skin of the left wing is peeling off, and it's flapping.
Whoa!
And every time it flaps, the plane makes a left bank. So it flaps 1, 2, 3 times. And then the whole front of the wing, the skin, falls off. It blows away. And the plane makes a sharp left bank and starts going in a like a long left turn and dropping through the cloud deck. We're going down, down, down. And the plane's making that sound that you hear in that you hear in the old, you know, like World War II movies where the plane's going, and it's the exact sound you don't want to hear.
So the dam busters.
Yeah, we're going down. Yeah, we're going down through the layers of clouds, 30,000 feet, 28,000 feet, 26,000 feet, and we're going and the plane is not letting up on this. And the only control you have over your entire environment was the volume control to watch the movie. There's nothing else to do. So the plane's going down and down and down and down and down, and we get through the bottom cloud layer, and you can see the ocean coming up toward us. So the plane finally, it starts to level off in this big, this, we've been making this big left turn all the way down in a spiral. And we get down to about 2,000 feet and the plane levels off and it's shaking like crazy. You can feel it in the armrest. You can hear it in the walls. And the wing on the left, this is a 747. The wing is bouncing. And there's this big, you can see the, you know, the green struts of the plane. I was like, well, I hope the Bernoulli principle holds up because we're still in the air. So if you remember on a 747, they have the spiral staircase. I was in the business section up toward the front, and they have the spiral staircase, and the co-pilot and the flight engineer come down and they've got a bunch of green binders in their hands. And they go down to the middle of the plane, and they start looking out the window. And they're looking at the binders and they're trying to figure out what's missing on the wing. And they're not talking to anybody, but they're looking out there and they say, that's there, that's gone, that's there, that's gone. And the plane's still shuddering. So then they go back upstairs without talking to anybody. And the pilot comes on the intercom and says, ladies and gentlemen, as you can tell, we've had a problem with the left wing and we seem to be having some problems with our stabilizer. So we will not be able to make it to Heathrow Airport. Everybody's like, well, what does that mean? So they cut off and then they come back and they said, we will be attempting a landing at Shannon. And then he cut off and everybody pulls out their magazines, you know, the in-flight magazine, trying to go through the map of where are we. And he comes back on and he goes, by the way, Shannon is in Ireland, which is 2 hours and 50 minutes ahead of us. So for the next 3 hours, we're going over the wave. I mean, we are like at 2,000 feet in a 747 on the ocean, and you can see the waves going by. I mean, it's just, it's very, very low. It's kind of like you feel like you're about to land, but that feeling of about to land goes on for 3 hours.
Wow.
And so we're and then decided to continue the movie if anybody was going to be watching. We get to Ireland and they make another long left turn. I think we covered the entire width of Ireland and to line up. And the pilot came out and said, the flight attendants will be coming through to explain to you about the brace positions. And this is why I can identify with Die Hard 2 a little too much. They show us how to, you know, put your hands against the seat and make sure that everything is put away. We come in and it was really one of the smoothest landings I've ever experienced. It was just, he barely touched the wheels onto the runway. And we rolled down to the end of the runway and we got up and looked out the window. I think every piece of fire equipment in Ireland was lined up on the runway. So it was nighttime when we got there. We deplaned. The business and the first class people actually had there was another aircraft that they could use, but they could only fit because of the 747 that they weren't expecting in Shannon Airport. They had a smaller airplane that they put the first class and business passengers on, and coach was left to fend for themselves in Ireland for another day. I got a hold of, I called my wife back in the States and I said, I know this is probably going to be on the news, but I just want to let you know that I landed safely in Ireland and we're going to go to Heathrow now. It took 3 days for my luggage to catch up with me in Heathrow. I made it to Heathrow safely, but we were the top story on CNN for about maybe 3 or 4 hours. But then Saddam Hussein decided to invade Kuwait. And so we got bumped off the headlines, but briefly we were a news story. anyway, everything, I made it back to, I made it back to America all right, and that was my excitement. And I keep telling my wife that you know, you're safe with me, because what are the odds of that happening to me twice? But then I remembered, look what happened to John McClane twice. So anyway, that's my airplane story. I hope you can enjoy it in the knowledge that
that was a great story. Now I remember where I was also on the day that Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So yeah, I remember that date very well.
Yeah, it was something. But I just remember that I was supposed to go to a business meeting, and the only thing that I had was my like traveling clothes. I wasn't traveling in a suit, so I showed up at the headquarters of British Aerospace in a shirt that I purchased, and I couldn't find pants that fit, so I went in jeans and a shirt and tie. It was very, it didn't go over with the British folks there very well, but once they heard my story, then I was like, oh, don't worry about it. So that was my excitement for that week. I know other people had other things going on that week.
That's right.
That was my adventure.
Fair enough. All right, Jim, you want to tell people once again how they can find Jim O'Kane?
Yeah, easy to find Jim O'Kane is at jimocane.com. You can see all the things I'm involved in, all my podcasts, all my other pages that I talk about space and things. I have a large TV section called TV Dads, where I follow the history of single dads on television. That's a nice place if you don't want to listen to, I know you're probably getting your fill of all my podcasts. If you'd like to read something for a change, go to tvdads.com and you can read all about the history of single dads on TV.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and there,